You're listening to the Disability Day broadcast on 3CR. 3CR acknowledges the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners, custodians, and caretakers of the lands from which this community broadcasts. With great respect for ancestors and elders, and descendants and kin who may be tuned in today. So I'm calling this show Art Chat because for the next half hour, we're going to be hearing two interviews with two incredible artists, Renee Barker-Mulholland and Pearl Black. Up first, here's Renee.
Yama. My name is Renee Barker-Mulholland and I am a proud Biripi Dungari woman, currently living on unceded Wadawurrung country. I would like to take a moment to pay my respects to country, to elders, to ancestors, to those who have paved the way for me to be here today.
So first I thought we'd introduce listeners who are meeting you for the first time to your arts practice. You are absolutely one of my favourite artists, and the Disability Day broadcast has been lucky to be able to commission you to make our poster artwork since 2021. What I love is how you intuitively connect with the briefs I've given you. I really can never predict what direction you'll take my briefs in, yet your art always somehow captures something that I was feeling but can't articulate. It's even captured visual symbolism that was swirling around my own head. Can you tell us about your arts practice, where it started, what art forms you create, and what drives your art making?
Very honoured and grateful to be having this conversation. Thank you, Pauline, for being a wonderful supporter of my work. I'm very proud to have been able to create the artwork for the Disability Day broadcast for 3CR since 2021. In terms of my arts practice, it's really hard for me to define it as something separate, something delineated from my life. It's always just existed. You know, from being very young and being out on country and gathering pretty things and then creating a collage or creating jewellery or creating a sculpture from that. It's always sort of been with me. Some of my favourite things to create are sculptures, are using found objects and using elements of the world around us and country to respect it and to recognise the beauty in it. I really enjoy creating clothing or I see fashion or wearable art. I prefer the term wearable art because the fashion industry I think is a completely separate entity. But wearable art is to me the ultimate form of self-expression. I think wearable art is definitely, it takes a big chunk of my passion, but you know, I am neurodivergent, so whatever I'm doing at the moment is something that comes from a place of genuine desire and passion to create that, whatever the medium is.
I listened to your interview with the I Can't Stand podcast, and at the beginning you talked about having both physical and invisible disabilities, but people tending to only see the physical and making assumptions about your capacity. I really relate to that. Can you talk about your disabilities and how they inform or affect your creative practice?
I do have both. I call myself physically and mentally non-compliant now. I do, as in I have physical and mental disabilities. Using being autistic or being neurodivergent as an example about how my disabilities inform my creative practice. For so long I existed and created without the knowledge that my brain might not have been the same as the majority of people that I was engaging with outside of my family and my friends, because at home, in my home I existed in a world where my differences, well, they weren't differences, but my behaviours because of my disabilities were not seen as negative or not seen as going against anything. So I think inherently from growing up in an environment where I was accepted and loved unequivocally and unconditionally, I think that definitely impacted how I view my disabilities and how I view my worth, and therefore how that impacts my artistic practice. Thematically, you cannot, whatever happens, I'm always going to be black first in this world. And that is always a source of pride for me, but obviously we live in a colony, and I am the undesired. So not being able to move past that, not because of a lack of desire, but because of an inherent environment, my art is always through that lens of black, non-compliant, femme. It's strange. I think subconsciously I adapt my artwork to be within my physical capacity, and if I have no mental capacity, creating art is very difficult for me. I think I integrate the, I suppose, limitations or the conditions in which I can create art because of my disabilities, but I do it without thinking. A large motivator for me to create art is to be able to cathartically release without having to overthink it, without having to rationalize or intellectualize it. It's almost like I the theme is me, and I can't go past that, or at this point I don't want to go past that barrier.
You've talked in the past about intuitive drawing. Could you explain what that is? I'm not a visual artist, but my writing for self-healing is intuitive, and so I'm really intrigued how this technique works for you in your visual practice.
Intuitive drawing is something that I do when I feel the need to create, but I don't have a desire to create a specific thing. So often, like for example, if I'm making wearable art, if I'm making, you know, a dress, for example, I might be inspired to make a dress because of the fabric that I have discovered, you know, at an op shop or at someone's gifted me. But if I just feel like being creative and I don't have any specific desire to or specific urge to do one particular thing, then often I'll do what I call intuitive drawing. It's just about drawing how you feel. And I think for me, it allows me to maintain a connection to what I consider as my spiritual self. So the self that is present but is not human, or is not expressed in a way that is perceived by humans. It can be hard if someone doesn't get the urge to be creative. Maybe it's kind of like stretching. You want to stretch. And when I draw and when I'm intuitive, I feel like I'm taking a really, really good stretch, and it's a lot of relief and just relaxation and a sensation of completeness. To do those, it can be hard to do that when I'm not feeling connected with myself, so it is very much about making sure that I have the time to connect with how I feel, so then, you know, I can draw what I feel. But I think the main thing about intuitive drawing and the main purpose of me doing so is, again, just to allow that connection to myself and to myself that's not a conscious thinker, to go beyond sort of what we're the day-to-day things. Generally, it looks like me telling my family that I need some space, or sitting down in front of the TV and putting on some music, or putting on, I really love putting on images of the ocean, or what am I trying to say? Things that are far away that you can see, but not necessarily have to be a far distance away from them. So you can look beyond the horizon or beyond what you're looking at and practice looking beyond that. And then, yeah, whatever medium feels good for my hand at the moment. So I suppose that does come into how my disability affects things. So if my arthritis in my hands is feeling like I can't do fine line drawing, then maybe I'll be painting, or maybe, you know, I can dye something, or I can use another technique. But what it comes down to is sitting in a quiet space with an opportunity for you to control the noise, the light, your little bubble, and just putting on the page, or putting on the cardboard, or putting on the cup, or whatever item that you're decorating or creating or drawing on, letting your body do that action and letting your body intuitively create that.
Lastly, let's talk about your writing. You have an absolutely stunning, moving, and damning piece in the current chronic illness issue of Rally Mag, which everyone should go out and buy immediately. In the piece, you tell the story of three generations of your family sustaining trauma from racism, ableism, sexism, and colonial bureaucracy within the mainstream Australian medical system. What inspired you to write this story, and what do you want readers, especially people who aren't disabled or who aren't experiencing poverty, to take away from it?
When Rally Magazine approached me to talk about chronic illness and life with disability, I had experienced, had this experience with having COVID and being tested. And it was, you know, I've had lots of medical trauma happen throughout my life, but it was during this episode of having COVID that it just became so starkly obvious to me that the system, the medical system, had caused irreparable damage to my family so often. And that each generation of my family had been impacted by it. And I think what my motivating factor when I was writing those pieces, and when I was talking about these stories, and, you know, sharing these really, that ultimately they're massive moments in my life that have, you know, will stay with me forever and have changed me, and I want to know, I want people to know that my experience of that wasn't because of choices that I made or something that I did wrong, or you know, it's compounding and it's and it's, we have no other option. Like, you know, the healing knowledge that we had, and that we, I mean, the healing knowledge that we had and the way to treat things that we had as mob was taken from us. And, you know, also so much of my trauma has come from navigating a colonial system. And I suppose I just wanted people to know, I wanted people to know that it was not because we had done something wrong, or that we, you know, were, that we had any control, we're at the mercy of, and it's current, you know, these things that are happening right now, they're happening today still. And, you know, these things that I've written about that happened 20 years ago, things like that still happen. And if me sharing my story can help someone understand that that's happening and that they need to help change things, you know, I'll tell anyone who will listen.
That was Renee Barker Mulholland. You can find Renee at the handle FirstNations_feminist on Instagram. So next I'm going to play for you a portion of an interview that I did with Pearl Black. Pearl is a Nigerian-Australian multidisciplinary artist residing on Wurundjeri country.
Hi. Well, yes, I'm Pearl. My pronouns are she, her, and I am the creative lead, and I like to sort of think of it myself as also the conceptualist, one of the conceptualists of the creative BIPOC Creative Access Collective. I have a mental health condition, and it also affects my cognitive ability. So this interview might be a good example of how it affects my cognitive ability. Sometimes my thought processes and my speech processes get a bit muddled, and also I can go off on tangents, which, you know, is really helpful for my creative process, and we'll probably talk a bit more about that later.
Ooh, I love a good tangent. Good. So now I want to know more about your passion project, the BIPOC Creative Access Collective. Can you tell us the full story of the journey of conceiving and nurturing this, who it is and what it is?
Oh, wow. That's such a big question. I guess, like, it does start with, you know, really dreaming up how to be as inclusive as possible. And that requires a lot of processing time, a lot of thinking, and a lot of allowing for time to bring ideas together, and also consulting with people and sort of running ideas past them, especially, deaf, disabled, BIPOC, deaf, disabled, and neurodiverse, divergent, there I go with my cognition, artists. And, without them, without, you know, community, it really wouldn't be possible to have an inclusive event or project. They really bring everything to the pie, so to speak, or to the melting pot. It really is about community, and it really is about access, and it really is about art, and it's about lived experience of all of those things, and just really an exchange of all of those ideas with as many people on board as possible to make it as evolutionary as possible, if I can kind of say that without it sounding too grandiose.
No, that sounds wonderful. It sounds like you are really wanting to create a space with other people that allows you to bring your whole selves to the space and create together.
Yes, absolutely. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's like complicated all of the time. Like the most recent, or the sort of more the inaugural or the opening event that we had recently for Alter State was very low key. It really, you know, it was like a beginning, you know, it's like a starting point where people could feel like their authentic selves, and they didn't have to actually, you know, be anything like other than how they wanted to show up. So, which was really important. You know, I think that's an important part of like creating as a process, is to have that time. It's very rare to have time to be able to create and to actually build a community to start off with.
The event that you're talking about is the BIPOC Artistic Intelligence Symposium. Can you tell us how this came about and what was the vision for it specifically?
It sort of came about by putting together a few grant applications over the years and not being successful with them. And then I sort of really pushed for it to kind of get seen by Arts Centre. And I'd been working with Arts Access Victoria for some time, trying to put a grant application together for it and find the right wording and things. Yeah, I just found that like this was just a really lucky thing after all that effort, I think. The vision was really just to, for me, as a sort of selfish thing, I guess, was to have a purpose and to really reclaim my identity because, I think I've been quite sheltered from being ostracized most of my life. From, family members and stuff like that, A, from having a disability and A, from being culturally different to, the broader community or the, the sort of Western or white community. And I just really wanted to explore what it would feel to be in a community that, may or may not have experienced similar. Because, my upbringing was predominantly in a white family. I just wanted to see, the intersections, like what differences are there in within the BIPOC, deaf, disabled and neurodivergent community, Because I don't believe that we're all that different to, we're all human. And I don't believe that we're all that different to, anyone else. We just get treated differently and equity is not like readily given to us as a community. So I think I really wanted to sort of start somewhere. And I thought, bringing people together that might not have those sort of equal opportunities would be, a good place to start.
Who were your collaborators for this symposium?
So I worked with Navikaran, who's a musician and sort of pop artist, I think. Very cool, great following and just really lovely and down to earth and really switched on. I loved working with her. And also Loz Serrano, who is a break dancer and personal trainer, is also a deaf, belongs to the deaf community as well. Then there was Natasha Pieris, who's a Ayurvedic practitioner. And we all kind of brought together, what it is to be embodied, embodying our identities and in different ways through our arts practices and through our lived experience of disability and deafness.
And from what I gathered, it seemed like there was an emphasis on sort of helping co-creators in the space ground themselves in their bodies.
Yeah, sure. So we started off with a presentation that I made, which was really connecting, establishing what's external and what's internal in terms of like expectations and that sort of thing, but it's sort of more metaphorical. So it was like having an object in your hands and, noticing the colours and the textures and the temperatures. And then translating that to how it feels within. And then I think Loz went into her lived experience of deaf dance and how, I don't know whether I should be speaking, but this is what she was sort of presenting, was that the way the energy moves through her And then Navikaran went into checking in with the breath, really just feeling what was comfortable for everybody, you know, asking them to check in with themselves and making sound or saying their name. Yeah, so it was really quite a flow-on effect, if you like, of sort of, you know, embodying identity and in a way that was comfortable, well, promoted to be comfortable for the participants that were there on the day.
I know that access, consideration, care, creative options and fun are what you focus on when you are leading group arts projects. And at the same time, accessibility in practical terms can be really quite complex, especially when you're working with, you know, groups of people who have a range of disabilities. Definitely resources help if you're working with an organization that has resources. How do you approach making the spaces and experiences you create accessible? And why do you think that that is essential in the arts?
I've gone about it in a way that I wouldn't recommend for other people to go in the same way, but I've done a lot of voluntary time to make sure that all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted, you know, and it's not just me like that's involved in this. It's like making sure that the people that I collaborate with are on the same page also. So deaf, disabled and neurodivergent artists have the same sort of scope in that they want to make the most inclusive and accessible event or project as possible. And with this particular event, there was an exchange with Multicultural Arts Victoria, and I think also Alter State as well, as a bit of a project or information exchange when it came to access. And so I gave some voluntary time to kind of, you know, talk about what, you know, my experience, just bringing in other people. I guess when you're bringing in like more community, then you get to learn about what other access requirements are needed, and then you can like grow from there. There's not like one mold for everybody, and it's never going to stay the same, I don't think. But if you approach it with an open mind and how can I do better, then, you know, it's kind of like a no-brainer in some ways, is that you're going to get better results each time. And I hope it just gets a little bit more fluid, just, you know, for the sake of being able to kind of, you know, get faster at it or something. But I don't know whether in the long term, I'd actually really like that, because it's part of the process is getting to know people and what their experience has been like and how to, you know, be resourceful around that. So I guess what I'm saying is I've kind of like compromised, you know, time and money, or money more so, for time, you know, to put the time in to make sure that people are looked after. And that's kind of one of the principles that I find that's most important to me, is to make sure that people are looked after rather than being paid, you know, for whatever, for doing that, you know. I think it's something that it's that extra 10% on top of the 100% that makes the magic happen.
That was Pearl Black. You can find Pearl on Facebook and Instagram under Pearl Black, spelled with two Ks. You've just listened to Our Chat, a special program for Embodied Solidarities, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast 2024. Stay tuned for more programming.
Zaikinaka, 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 muzomotuka, zaikinaka, 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 muzomotuka. Kazaki naka, sangre, sangre, sangre.